that's what's interesting about neuroscience is neuroscience offers us a toolkit to measure people's emotional responses. So whereas they took pictures of buildings and had people rate them, in our lab, we use immersive virtual reality. So it's pretty real environments. We use Unity to build these urban landscapes. And I varied building height in these immersive virtual environments to just look at how the feeling of having these really tall buildings around you affect your stress response.
I'm John Lewis, and you're listening to 360 Degree City, a podcast where we talk to all kinds of folks that are making life in cities better. Our hope is at the end of each episode, you'll start to see your own city from a slightly different angle. How we design our cities impacts how we feel. From green spaces and tree-lined streets to walkable neighborhoods and lively public places, there are many design considerations that can increase well-being. And then, there are the 50-story skyscrapers, 10-lane highways, and endless acres of parking lots, which are argued to lead to increased stress and decreased well-being. This idea of designing cities to maximize well-being has been a hot topic in recent years. But how does one actually measure the relationship between urban design and mental health? Can we quantify and analyze how urban design choices, such as tall skyscrapers, make us feel? Today's guest is doing just that.
My name is Robin Mazumder, and I'm currently doing my PhD in cognitive neuroscience at the University of Waterloo. And I'm looking at how the built environment of a city influences the way that we feel and the way that we behave.
In today's episode, Robin and I talk about how we went from an undergrad in biology to a career in occupational therapy to a PhD in neuroscience. What Robin has discovered so far about how being in the presence of skyscrapers makes people feel, and some cities that are doing well and some that aren't in terms of designing for well-being. Let's dive in.
So I did my undergraduate education in biology with the intention to go to med school. But while I was in my undergrad, I started doing a lot of volunteer work with an organization called Recreation Integration Victoria. And with them, I did a lot of community inclusion work with kids with disabilities. And that ended up taking me to Siberia for 3 months, where it was kind of crazy. The Canadian government had this fund for universities to develop partnerships with Russia at the time. And my friend and I, we basically applied, we got some money, and I spent 3 months working in Siberia with kids with disabilities over there and teaching local organizations how to address inclusion, because stigma around disability at the time, and I think still is, pretty bad. And so, you know, we were just trying to share the type of work that we were doing in Canada. Anyways, when I was there, I really realized that I really enjoyed working with people and helping people, especially in that context and that kind of rehab-focused, inclusion-focused context. And so I got back to Canada and I worked a desk job for about a year at a nonprofit that looked at assistive technology. And the executive director there said, listen, you seem like you kind of, you're not really, this might not be the best fit for you. You know, he's like, you seem like a people person, and being behind a computer may not be where your passions lie. So he's like, you know, my daughter has an occupational therapist, and I think that maybe you should check it out. Like, have you ever thought of occupational therapy? And so then I applied to OT school, not knowing anything about it, and ended up getting in, and thank God, really aligned with, you know, my values. And so I ended up doing my master's in occupational therapy at the University of Toronto. And there I learned about a completely different way of kind of seeing health and well-being. And occupational therapists really kind of distinguish themselves amongst all of the healthcare professions in that we really look at how someone's environment shapes how they function and feel. So we try to help people engage in meaningful activities, or what occupational therapists called occupations. But it's really understanding how someone's environment influences their engagement in those sorts of things. So I finished my master's and I started working in mental health, in community mental health, at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, with people with schizophrenia and a number of mental health issues. And my job there was really to get people to live successfully in the community, because keeping them in the hospital was costing the system a lot of money. And besides that, it's much better for people to live included in their community than it is to in some, you know, dormitory in an institution. So in that process, I was really like reflecting a lot on how the environment of the city was influencing the way that my clients that I was supporting at the time were feeling. And then I ended up moving to Edmonton and doing similar work there. And in Edmonton, I got really, really involved with like urbanism. And I started seeing how the city kind of functioned internally and how urban planners kind of shaped, you know, how that kind of worked. And I was like, I really started to wonder about this connection between urban design and mental health. And around that same time, I started to get kind of burnt out from the work that I was doing as an occupational therapist. It's pretty taxing, emotionally taxing work if you get a little too involved. And I'm a sensitive guy, so I don't think I was really taking care of myself in the process. So I took a break from that for a year, and I ran a startup accelerator, which is crazy because I don't really have that kind of a background, but they had faith in me. And so I worked at this polytechnic called NAIT, the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology, and I ran their startup accelerator. And as part of the training that I got for that, they brought the Stanford Design Thinking School, the D School, to Edmonton to train a bunch of people in the kind of innovation world on how to help their, you know, students or whoever they're serving design good products, whether it was apps or physical objects. And there was this step in the design thinking that was focused around empathy and how empathy really enhances our ability to develop something that really meets the needs of the user. And I had this moment where I was like, oh my God, like, and I'm probably definitely not the first person to think of this, but it was like this big revelation, because I was from my occupational therapy training where I was empathizing with clients to help them just, you know, provide better therapy for them, to now looking at, you know. And I should say, in the process of working with a lot of clients with a lot of mental health issues and physical health issues, I saw that the city didn't really meet their needs a lot. And I was, when I had this training, I was like, oh my God, like, we need to empathize with people in designing cities. And I was thinking, like, what's like the most like fine-tuned way to empathize with someone? It's like to look at like how they experience the world in first person. And that's essentially psychology. And around that time, I saw a tweet on Twitter with this article in it about how boring cities are bad for your mental health. And I clicked it, and it was written by my current PhD supervisor. And I was like, this is like amazing. This is exactly what I want to do with my life. And so I called him, and then 3 months later, I started my PhD at the University of Waterloo. So it was a really weird kind of path, but retrospectively, like, everything makes complete sense, as it always does. But I think all my experience are playing a role in where I am today and how I see things.
Yeah, like you say, it all makes sense. Like, each step kind of leads to the next. And, you know, starting with, I took 3 months in Siberia, which I've never talked to anyone that's ever said that. But that's really interesting. And one of the things I was excited to talk to you about is just this perspective that you're bringing. And we'll get into it in a little bit here. But the merging of what you do with, you know, being leading with empathy, but then also bringing real science into it and blend, you know, dovetailing those two things is something that city builders often miss, right? So what you're describing is putting, you know, seeing the city through the lens of other kinds of people with other kinds of needs from yourself. And whereas a lot of city builders will see it through a professional lens of, you know, does this fit with the zoning bylaw or, you know, those kinds of things, which are often ignorant, completely ignorant of how it actually impacts real human beings. So, pretty fascinating. So one of the things I wanted to chat with you about was the areas of urban design that you're studying. So obviously there's so many different components to a city. Are there any particular aspects to the built form or the lived experience of a city that you're paying particular attention to in your studies?
For a dissertation, it's got to be super specific. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, you can't be jack of all trades with a neuroscience thesis. Yeah. You have to really choose something really specific and easily kind of a variable that you can manipulate easily to test different effects. And so The thing that I'm really focusing on for my dissertation is looking at how being in the presence of skyscrapers influences our, or how the perception of being in the presence of skyscrapers, really tall buildings, makes us feel, and measuring that. And it's actually based on a landscape architect professor from Harvard did a research study about 5 years ago, and he looked at this quality called oppressiveness. And his work was based on work that was done in Japan in like the 70s and 80s, where they looked at this term, which they called apakukan, which basically translates into pressure or psychological pressure. And they were suggesting that especially in Tokyo, where you've got really narrow roads and really tall buildings, that feeling of, it's a feeling of crowdedness. And apakukan refers to the sensation that one would get when they're surrounded by a lot of people, when they're in a building or in a room with low ceilings, or when they're surrounded by these really tall buildings. Like, the word has multiple meanings to it. And so this landscape architect at Harvard, they looked at basically getting people to rate tall buildings on oppressiveness, and or pictures of tall buildings. And so they basically, from there, they made some suggestions that, yeah, people find tall buildings oppressive, but that they are also causing stress and anxiety. And but they didn't really measure that. And I think, and that's probably because they didn't have, you know, the tools to do it. But that's what's interesting about neuroscience, is neuroscience offers us a toolkit to measure people's emotional responses. So whereas they took pictures of buildings and had people rate them, in our lab, we use immersive virtual reality. So it's pretty real environments. We use Unity to build these kind of urban landscapes. And I varied building height in these immersive virtual environments to just look at how the feeling of having these really tall buildings around you affect your stress response. So basically it was kind of like trying to replicate what they did, but put a bit of a twist on it with our methods in terms of how we measured things, their people's, you know, physiological responses, and also how we expose people to these different conditions.
Okay. So those virtual reality landscapes, are those real landscapes, or you're creating them in the virtual environment to really be able to test various heights and designs, I guess?
Yeah. So they're virtual. So they're not real settings, but we're also interested in those real settings. And so part of the work that I'm doing in London is exactly that. So I'm taking people to areas of central London where there are tall buildings, and then measuring their physiological responses using some wearables that we have, and then seeing how that changes, and also measuring some psychological variables through a smartphone app. And then we're seeing how that changes, based on the setting. And I mean, ultimately, in our work, it's as cities are becoming, you know, more populated, we can't disregard that skyscrapers are going to be built. But it's more about just understanding the effect it can have. And then, you know, on top of that, what are some design interventions you can use at the ground level, or what kinds of things can you do to mitigate some of that feeling? Because it's, I don't know about you, but I that's not just because I'm researching this, but I feel there's a tangible difference when I'm in a really dense city with really tall buildings around me, and or versus on like on a street like Queen Street West or something, or like, you know, a very human scale street. And so I'm curious as to how we can get the effects that people experience on a human scale street in that dense city. And so that's kind of where I'm going with some of my research.
Okay. Yeah. So could you describe, you mentioned wearables and things. I'm curious just about how you understand the effects on your subjects. Just kind of a new area for me, and just to help our listeners understand. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a number of variables that we can look at that are basically proxies of what's happening in the brain. So in terms of stress, so there's some studies where you can actually literally stick people in an fMRI machine, but that it's pretty intensive, and virtual reality and exploring environments doesn't really jive with that if you're lying immobile in an fMRI machine. So we use other methods, which we call psychophysiology, to get at that. So we look at heart rate variability. We look at blood pressure. Some people look at muscle tension, because muscle tension is, or, you know, an indication of you're tense. And so that's an indication of stress. Mm-hmm. But one of the main variables that we look at is called electrodermal activity. It's also known as the galvanic skin response or skin conductance. And basically that is, we measure people's emotional sweat rate. So people obviously sweat to thermoregulate. You know, I'm sweating right now because it's really hot in London, and that's to keep my body cool. But we also sweat when we have an emotional response. And we have a high density of what they call eccrine sweat glands in our palms, on the bottoms of our feet, you know, on our armpits and our forehead. And, like, you know, you can picture someone when they're getting nervous about to give a talk or something, or they're in an interview and, like, they're sweating. That's that emotional sweat response. And that's what we measure. And the way we measure it with these wearables is you're basically calculating the conductance, the speed at which electricity can be conducted on your skin, because that's basically an indication of the amount of electrolytes on your skin, which makes it quicker to travel. So you just measure the speed of a current between two points. Typically, it's on your index and ring fingers that we put these on. And that's basically it. And it's interesting because that only gives us one element of someone's state of arousal, because someone can be in a positive state and, like, excited, and they will have an emotional sweat response, or they can be deathly afraid of something or just irritated, and they would also probably have that same response. So that only gives us one side of the story. Then we have to supplement that with psychological questionnaires. So we looked at implicit kind of unconscious emotional measures, and we also look at explicit measures where people, you know, we just ask them how they're feeling. And then that gives us the emotional valence to complement the physiological readings to give us a complete story of what's going on for the person at the time.
Wow. And so with the evolution of technology and wearable technology and things, is it like how like 5 years ago, 10 years ago, would you have been able to do the kinds of studies that you're doing?
Yeah. So skin conductance has actually been around for a really long time. They used to use it to diagnose illness in like the late 1800s, 1900s. But it was a giant contraption, you know. Over time. And the other cool thing is, so skin conductance has been around for a while. Even in like 80s and 90s, people were doing some research with it. But the machine was pretty big and it wasn't mobile. So the stuff that we have now, which is really cool, is it's basically a watch, right? You know, and so that technology is developing at a pretty fast rate. And it's interesting because I feel like I'm in the middle space where there's still some issues, but I think in like 5 or 10 years, it might even just be on all wearables, because right now most wearables don't have skin conductance. The ones that we use are pretty expensive, and they're actually designed to help monitor people for epilepsy. It's a medical device that, it's pretty crazy. It's linked up to someone's phone, and then if someone has and skin conductance is one of the measures or one of the indicators of someone having a seizure coming on. So this app basically turns on, lets the doctor know so that everyone's ready for this to happen. So, but, you know, all sorts of companies are increasingly interested in people's emotional state, you know, which I think is something that could probably be exploited.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. If, like, your wearable is like detecting that you're in a, you know, a bad mood or something, and then your phone, they're like, you know, maybe they'll give you an ad for something that they know that you use when you're in a bad mood, you know,
so like some chocolate or like whatever,
kind of crazy. Or here's a coupon for like the bar down the street or something like that. But anyways, yes. But I think look at Fitbits and how that's evolved. Mm-hmm. Now, almost all of them have heart rate monitors. You know, 2-3 years ago, it was a luxury the most premium edition had like a heart rate monitor. Now they've got heart rate monitors. And even from that, you can pick up someone's emotional state. It's not as directly connected as the electrodermal response, but So I think with technology in the next 5, 10 years, it's just going to get even more and more honed into someone's emotional experience.
Yeah. And so with your work and your study of various impacts of skyscrapers to date, have you found anything that stands out so far in terms of how urban design and these kind of design issues affect the health of citizens?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still writing out my manuscript, so nothing's published, so I can't definitively say it.
Yeah.
But the findings that we do have would suggest that there is a negative affective kind of response to these kind of conditions. But I think the bigger picture of my research is not just how these settings make people feel, but also how they behave in a social capacity. So,
okay.
Yeah. So it's like, how does being in these settings affect socialization and social connection? Mm. And so I'm also curious about how that manifests on the street level. You know, do our surroundings, are there some surroundings that are more conducive to us being more interested in connecting with people than other settings? So,
right.
Yeah, that's still to come.
yeah, for sure. Stay tuned. Yeah, because and it'll be interesting just to see the how the results in terms of skyscrapers and just always that, you know, that city building conversation around a lot of people equate density to something like a skyscraper. But, you know, when as an example, when I was studying in Barcelona as part of my master's program, I lived near the Sagrada Familia, and there is nothing over besides the cathedral, like over six stories. And so some classmates and I did a quick study. And so there's about 25,000 people per square kilometer in that neighborhood. And then when we went back to Calgary, we said, okay, just a rough citywide estimate. And it was about 1600 people per square kilometer. So the density is just through the roof, but there is nothing over six stories. So it'll be interesting, just like the, like you mentioned, the human scale and active streets and what that does to the impacts of all these other people and those kinds of things.
Yeah. I'm really excited. Nothing may come of it, but I'm optimistic, and I think that there's some things we can learn about that for sure.
Yeah, I've been following your work and you're really generous on your blog and your posts about your thoughts and how your findings are you're sharing them with city builders. And there's that quote, I think it's from Death and Life of Great American Cities from Jane Jacobs, that says calls urban planning or city planning a pseudoscience, and now it's so what's exciting is you're actually bringing real science to inform city builders.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I have a lot of urban planner friends, like all over the world now, just through like some of the, you know, being involved in giving talks at conferences or just living in different cities and meeting people, and I think that urban planners have the most important job like out there. And I don't think it's, I think it can be seen as pseudoscience, you know, when people make haphazard kind of, you know, non evidence based decisions. And I think one of the challenging things, I was tweeting with someone a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking about how we need different disciplines involved in the urban planning conversation. And this person tweeted back at me. He's like, this is so problematic, you know, that urban planners aren't seen as experts anymore, and then it's turned into this kind of community conversation. And I actually think that a lot of the challenge behind that is, you know, you guys get trained, you go through your education, but that gets complicated when urban planning decisions are basically done through a political lens. And so, yeah, I mean, when Jane Jacobs said the pseudoscience thing, I don't believe that. I think that you guys do have a science, and I'm hopefully helping contribute to that as an outsider from like a neuroscience healthcare perspective. But no, I think it's definitely an exciting profession that has a theoretical framework that drives the things that you do. It just gets a little complicated because you don't often get to do the things that you want, because you have to manage public perception and the politics of the whole situation as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the most dangerous piece of the whole, you know, planner specifically is, you know, they're a lot of planners, their job is to codify these ideas, and hopefully there's some evidence and some foundations to it. But then some cities or professionals or what have you, the focus becomes protecting the code instead of what is the code trying to enable. And then, you know, right. You can sort of lose the plot by just making sure that everything sticks to the rules. But what are the rules trying to serve? You know, so that's exactly. ever evolve, all in, like you say, all within a political context. So, yeah. Yep. So do you have any examples, either good or bad, of cities or parts of cities that you've experienced or studied that have, like I say, a positive or negative effect on mental health of people that are walking around those cities?
Yeah. I mean, so in 2016, our lab collaborated with, I'm sure you know Charles Montgomery in the Happy City. Mm-hmm. People. Yeah. So Charles and our lab, we do a lot of collaborative research studies together. And so we did one in Vancouver, we got ethics from the University of Waterloo. It was like a actual study.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so, you know, it was pseudoscientific. We had to like apply like research rigor and scientific rigor to like the process. But we basically we partnered with the Project for Public Spaces, Pro Walk, Pro Bike. I always screw it up. Pro Walk, Pro Bike, Pro Place, whatever conference in Vancouver that year, because there's like 1,000 urbanists from all over the world, and we're like, that's perfect for like a participant pool. And we took 100 people on a short walk around Davie Village, which is like a block from where the conference is happening. And we had three pairings of sites that, but all involved a really simple intervention. And we were looking at how really basic community building, kind of tactical urbanism type interventions could improve people's well-being and their sociability and their happiness and whatnot. And we had we paired a really basic, bland, hardscape laneway to a green laneway just a block away that people had planted shrubbery. There was a place to sit. There was a little free library. We compared a rainbow crosswalk to, you know, a normal crosswalk. And the last pairing we had was we compared a community garden, which is a block away from the plaza, the park that was at the Sheraton Plaza where the conference was. And what was interesting about that plaza or that park was that it was built, as far as I understand, and I might be wrong, but it was built because the Sheraton wanted to build taller than they had originally in their original proposal. And as through a consultation process, the city said, well, yeah, if you build a park here for public use, then you can, yeah, sure. That'll be like, you can build that and then you can build, do what you want.
The old density bonus.
Yeah. But what ended up happening was this really shitty park. And I wouldn't even say it was a park. It's an overly manicured kind of garden, grid lawn with signs saying, don't sit on the grass. Pretty sure there was a security guard out there half the time monitoring, you know, who was using it. The seating wasn't comfortable. It was really sterile. And that particular pairing, we're looking at this idea of, you know, privately owned public space, where on one hand, you've got a community garden that's, you know, people are literally taking food out of it, you know, and they are occupying it as much as they want and how they want, versus this other quote unquote green public space where, you know, no one's there. And if they do try to, you know, have any psychological ownership of the space by sitting on the grass or whatever, they'll be told to move. And so we had those three pairings. And what was really interesting was we found that, you know, all of our hypotheses around, you know, the pairings, like the green back alley laneway was obviously on a number of measures more desirable and happy and welcoming and sociable than the hardscape laneway. And the same thing with the rainbow intersection and the blank intersection. But we actually didn't find much of a difference. We got null results for the findings between the community garden and that plaza. And we realized kind of retrospectively what we call post hoc analysis of that was that week was when the conference was going on. And so the space was pretty much occupied by urbanists. People were sitting on the lawns. They took the signs out of the ground, like, you know, some urban tactical urbanism. Someone put "please sit on the lawn" where there's a "don't sit" or something like that. So it was interesting. We didn't get any differences in the findings there, but it spoke to how important it is to get people in public space and how the presence of other people can modify our appraisals of it. So yeah, to answer your question, I think in general, sorry, I went on a bit of a research tangent.
That's great.
But in general, I think Vancouver is doing really well. Vancouver, I mean, beyond its affordability kind of issue, the city offers a pretty well-rounded, you know, from their mode share is pretty high as compared to other cities because they build good quality infrastructure. They make it easy for people to use transit or as easy as they can. And the city is appropriately dense. You know, it's not spreading out because of the confines of the mountains and the water. So I think Vancouver is probably a really good, you know, from an urban design perspective and well-being, I think is doing a lot of really good stuff. I mean, obviously they've got the, you know, they've got mountains and park, an abundance of park space. So there's some things that is hard to replicate when it comes to what Vancouver offers. Mm-hmm. But from the decisions that they make, I think they do really well. And when it comes to a city that's, you know, not doing the best, I think a lot of like just southwestern Ontario in general. So I've been living in Kitchener-Waterloo for like the last 3 years. That's where I'm doing my PhD. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of potential there, but it's still super, super car centric. And a lot of places, Kitchener and Waterloo aren't the only ones, you know, like London, Ontario, Hamilton's doing a bit of stuff. From an urban design perspective, they're still very, very car centric. And I see how that manifests in terms of just vibrancy on the streets. You know, they aren't busy at night. Like I'm living in London for the summer here, and London's also a world city. A lot of people that live here. So I'm not going to compare small towns in Ontario to London, but it's just amazing to see how designing with a human scale, making streets friendlier for people, gets people out.
Yeah.
You know? And the other thing that you mentioned with like Barcelona, which, you know, we've got a lot of people living in a small area, but they don't have skyscrapers, but they still manage to have high density is, what's really cool about it here is that people actually use public space because they have to, you know,
right.
You don't have, there's no backyards here, or there are, but they're tiny. And so this kind of shoving a lot of people into a little bit of space actually makes them want to go outside. Whereas in a lot of these towns that I mentioned, like there's an abundance of space, the roads are big because they want people to be able to drive home fast, you know, quickly. From Toronto probably. And so you don't see that spill out onto the street because there's no need to. And so I think it's interesting with these places kind of struggling with housing, like London is, because I have 40-year-old professional friends here who have like four roommates because that's just the reality. And so you see them out more often and using parks and like hanging out on the streets because that's their backyard. That's their living room, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you could see how, you know, with the difficulty on so many realms with the car centric, design of cities, it's so hard to get off that treadmill, you know, cause the, yeah, yeah. And I mean, if like with your frame on, healthy cities and well-being, it's, you know, I would imagine that a lot of people that are making choices to live in communities that are car centric, which leads to car centric cities, are probably doing so because of personal preference, at least for some folks, personal preference and what they would equate to as well-being, that they have their own yard and their own space. But then cumulatively across all those decisions, you end up with a city in sort of in its entirety that is less healthy for everybody.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm thinking about like, you know, yeah, in Canada, the dream is like you want a big house with a big backyard and, you know, a double car driveway.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time these spaces go unused. Half the house isn't occupied. Like you could like heat map how someone uses their house and guaranteed 60% to 70% of the house probably won't even be occupied or used at any given point.
Yeah.
The backyard's empty. But it's funny, you go like here in the parks, like kids are playing, like complete stranger kids are playing together because that's their, like, that's their backyard. And I think that's just so much more meaningful and so much better for our mental health and our physical health to be, you know, forced to connect with other people instead of driving into your 2-car garage so you don't even see the neighbors, you know, going inside and then, you know, maybe having a barbecue once every 2 years in your backyard or something like that.
So. Yeah, for sure. I saw something that was probably a month ago on Twitter. There is a recent study. I think it was American households, and it did just that. It showed that heat map, and it was, you know, like the living room and the kitchen and everything else was pretty much empty all, you know, throughout the day. There was no indication that people were there other than to sleep, but everyone spent their waking hours in those two rooms where you could have whatever 2,000 square feet, 3,000 square feet of empty space to store your stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the last question I have for you is something we ask all the guests, and it makes them all angry because I asked for a single place, but can you identify a city that you love and why you love it?
Yeah. Easy. Berlin.
All right.
Yeah. Berlin is, it's accessible. It's human scale. There's a rich sense of place and culture there. It's affordable. There's just something for everyone in that city. And the feeling I got from Berlin, it's just this sense of, it's a grittiness, you know, it's this kind of like work in progress feel, like people build these like crazy bars with like, you know, colorful material. And like, it's not contrived, you know, they're not like, I think people go to places like Berlin and then they go to their own city and they try to do that. And, or they'll try to, you know, hipsterize. Like Berlin does what hipsters are doing, but it does it like effortlessly, you know? And, and I just love that about that city. And it's, you know, very diverse and multicultural. Yeah. That was like the first thing that came to mind. I guess I will say though that like London's really growing on me. You know, I've been living here, it's been 2 months. The city is just like insanely expensive and I don't think I could, you know, do that long of a time here. But
yeah,
this I think it's a close number two just because I've been exploring it as at every chance I get. I got a bike out here, so I'm out checking out the different neighborhoods, and there's just this kind of, there's a vitality to the city that's enlivening. Like if I'm feeling, you know, lonely or like low energy, I just have to remind myself to go walk out the door.
Yeah.
And there's so much interesting stuff happening around me, and it's amazing. You know, I don't have that luxury where I live in Kitchener. Like if I walk out the door, like I might not see anybody like on the streets, and it makes me feel lonelier, you know? So
yeah,
I've been really appreciating that about London.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Robin. His diverse background and rigorous research brings a unique perspective to understanding our cities, and I'm excited to hear more about his findings. If you want to hear more of Robin's unique insights, I strongly recommend checking out his blog. He's covered a lot of topics, from the importance of libraries and bike lanes, to designing with dignity, and what city builders can learn from Burning Man. You'll find his blog in our show notes, or you can go to robinmazumder.com. 360 Degree City is created by the team at Intelligent Futures. To learn more about the work we do, you can go to intelligentfutures.ca. The music in this episode and in all our episodes is by Sound of Picture. If you like the podcast, please share it with someone that might be interested in seeing their own city from a different angle. We would love it if you subscribed and reviewed the podcast, and would love to hear your feedback. If you have any suggestions for future guests or topics that you'd like us to cover, get in touch with us on our website or any of our social accounts. I'm John Lewis. Thanks for stopping by.